I just tell you that I think an awful lot of the people that are involved in American Cassette Ministries, I don't have any involvement particularly with them, certainly no financial connection. But every once in a while when we're out doing programs, they make it a point of coming and recording and then making things available in a cassette ministry to other people. And I've really appreciated over the years what they do. Very creative people, the kind of people that are a real resource in the church. So we appreciate your help for them. Well, it was late afternoon in the big island of Hawaii. And out in the city of Hilo, Aloha Airlines Flight 243 was just about getting ready to depart. And up front, the cockpit crew was busy with their last-minute checklist before pushing back for taxi to the active runway. And just behind them, standing in the door of the airplane, was the first-class stewardess who was greeting the passengers and hanging up the coats for the first class and so forth. They closed the door. They had about 90 passengers aboard and four air crew members. They pushed back and they began taxiing to the active. The pilot who was flying that late afternoon was a gal by the name of Madeline Tompkins. Her friends all call her Mimi. And to her left, the captain on the flight, was an ex-Air Force flight instructor by the name of Bob Schornsteimer. And Bob had this thing that when it was time to fly, the pilot would fly one leg and the co-pilot would fly the next. They just went odds and evens so that the crew would get equal airtime. And it was Mimi's leg to fly. The longest one of the day, 41 minutes, block to block, Hilo to Honolulu International. They went out there and lined up on runway 26, and about a mile, 2 miles of concrete stretched ahead of them. Way out in the distance, out there just to the right of the nose, was about 14,000 feet worth of Mauna Kea. Tower called them, said 243, you're cleared for takeoff. After takeoff, turn right, maintain 300 degrees. Mimi gave them a big roger and advanced the thrust levers. And from the left seat, Bob Schornsteimer, as professional aircrew people do, was guarding the thrust levers with his hand so that if Mimi had a seizure on the takeoff, she wouldn't pull back on one throttle and send the airplane off into the weeds. About 35 seconds later, they're climbing. The right turn commences. Mauna Kea drops off to the left, and they head for 24,000 feet. Well, everything's going routine. The first-class flight attendant unbuckles from her three-point harness and gets up and begins to take care of the first-class passengers, passing out juice and snacks. It's only going to be a 40-minute flight, so she doesn't have time for much. For some reason, Mimi is hand-flying. They're not on autopilot. She levels off at flight level 240, 24,000 feet, rolls in a little nose-down trim to get the thing settled down, adjusts power. And everybody relaxes. When that happens, when you get the airplane level in cruising flight and all cleaned up, you kind of let a little breath out and you relax and say it's really all the way home now, pretty easy until we get our descent clearance. At which point, they heard the kind of sound you hope you never hear in the air. From just about 3 feet behind them, ka-wah, and the whole roof of the airplane, 18 feet worth, blows off out of the first class section. And with it goes the first class flight attendant. She's gone. The explosive decompression yanks the door separating the flight deck from the rest of the airplane off, and it sails out into about 5 miles of nothing. Now they're up there over the channel between those two islands. And they're in real trouble. Very soon, the Christmas tree on the panel starts to light up. Systems are starting to drop off. The left engine is gone. Because when the airplane lost its roof, the floor buckled. It kind of turned like a sausage. And the controls to the left engine severed, and that's it. Number one went off the line, and they start down. Well, Mimi's first reaction is, I got to call Honolulu Center and tell them what's going on. So she keys the mic by pushing a button on her control yoke. And then she realized she ain't talking to anybody because her headset has been yanked off her head and it's gone out into 5 miles of nothing. And pretty soon, the eddies from the air swirling around in what's left of the airplane are sucking up soft drink cans and coffee cups and stuff, and they're swirling around the flight deck in between the two pilots. They can't hear each other because the noise is so deafening, so by hand signals, they each decide they better try to make it down to a nearby island. just across Alanui'aha Channel. And they head right for the coast of Maui. Now they start down, and Bob realizes that there's real trouble with that airplane. As he moves the control yoke, by this time he has taken over the airplane. Doesn't move freely. You see, on a 737-200, the controls are just physically connected with the control yoke that the pilots have through cables that run all the way under the floor, up to the elevators, and so forth. And what's happened is the whole airplane is now slightly bent, and those conduits that the control cables are running through are chafing. You're trying to pull wire through something where it's bent, and they're working real rough. They come down to about 10,000 feet and level off, and Bob says to himself, I'm going to have to find out if this airplane will land. So he very gingerly starts deploying flaps. All of a sudden, the airplane starts shaking. Now, when an airplane shakes, it's telling you, I'm just about to quit flying. So he dumps the flaps, and down they come. Problem is, there's a volcano in their way. So they kind of dogleg around the volcano. They're all the time coming down. Now the number two engine is at full takeoff power, and they're still descending, so they ain't going to go around. Whatever's in front of them, they're going to land on it. And up there at Kahului, there's an airport visible through the clouds that they decide to line up on. And they continue their descent. The captain indicates, I want the gear down, so Mimi reaches over and pulls that little round lever that is shaped like a landing gear, and the gear comes down, and they can feel it bump. They get two green lights, which mean the two main wheels are down and locked, but they don't get any green on the nose, which tells them they don't know whether the nose gear is down and locked or not. Mimi tries the various alternative procedures to be sure that it gets down. They can never confirm that it is down, but the one thing they know for certain is they're going to be landing in just a few minutes. As they go to line up on short final on runway 2 at Kahului, now they're dodging clouds. It's kind of semi-instrument weather, and they're trying to find their way down through a lot of visual obscuration. And finally, as they approach the runway, would you know it? Nothing else has gone right today, and this is going to be wrong too. The wind's across the runway at 18 knots. It's going to be a crosswind landing. Right over the numbers, Schornsteiner chops the power all the way back to idle. And the next thing that happens is that the airplane settles on just beyond the numbers, and 5,500 feet later, it comes to a stop. He's got full reverse thrust on the right engine, and he's standing on the left brakes. Mimi Tompkins later said it was a greaser, an absolutely perfect landing. I remember asking myself, how did he do that? Well, let me tell you how he did it. But first of all, let's recognize something. Airplanes have fallen out of the sky many, many times, thousands of times, with far poorer excuses than that. That airplane had every right to die. You get a jetliner with 18 feet of roof gone and the hull held together by the seat tracks, you don't have any right to walk off that thing. The only right you got is to get in the newspaper. The way he did it was that there are 17 emergency checklists for the 737-200. Bob Schornsteiner went through 17 of those on the way down from memory because there wasn't time to open the book and look it up. See, back in ground school, when a lot of pilots were sitting there saying, this is boring, I want to get in the air, and I don't happen to really care how many pounds per second of fuel each engine is sucking up at a given flight attitude, or it doesn't really matter to me so much what all 17 of those checklists say, because I can always look in the book. When others were coasting through the program, Bob was learning what it took to bring 94 people back to Mother Earth. Now, the question that comes to your mind is this. Seems like everywhere you go, whether it's in an airliner cockpit or in an academy classroom, you look around the group, your peers, the people that are going through the same level, same time you are, and pretty soon in that group, a few of them begin to stick out. They are doing something more with their lives than the rest of the group. Seems like any place, any time, there's a special few who can turn an ordinary job into something extraordinary. Now, why do some people succeed when others don't? Ever wonder about that? I don't think it's because others couldn't. I've got a hunch that a few succeed because they keep in mind a very special gift they've got. They know who they are. They have confidence in their own identity. Now let's talk about that, shall we? I've got this theory that everybody in this world is born with something absolutely priceless, and that's the identity God gave you. I mean, you are a custom-made creation. There's not another one like you anyplace, and you're not here by accident. The Lord means for you to be here, and He made you hands-on. Now, that isn't the gospel according to Walton. That's out of the good book. If you got a Bible with you, you might want to follow along with me and turn to Genesis 1. Genesis 1, beginning with here in verse 26. And God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness. Let them have dominion over the whole world." Now, what did He say? Let us what? Make mankind, men and women. You look it up, and in the Hebrew, that word make is the Hebrew word asah. And what that means is hands in the mud. I mean, He's physically creating a human being. It isn't something where He's off in the cosmos saying, let it happen. I mean, He's down there, hands in the mud. He is making, custom making this thing called a human life. Well, you can say that's no big thing. That's Adam. Of course, we know God made Adam and Eve. But let me tell you something that doesn't stop there. Let's turn now to Ecclesiastes 11:5. Ecclesiastes 11:5 gives us a view of the exact same thing. It says, "As thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit, or how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child, even so thou knowest not the works of God, who," what's the next word? "Who maketh all." Maketh. Would you like to tell me what Hebrew word is used where it refers to God making a human being inside a mother? Same one, asah, hands-on, custom-built. Okay? Turn to Job 31:15. You're going to see the whole thing happen again. Job 31, and down around the 15th verse. "Did not He that made me in the womb make him? And did not one fashion us in the womb?" Same word again, asah. God is custom building this thing called a human being. Now, I'm not going to bore you with more detail. If you want to look it up for yourself, try Isaiah 44:2 and Jeremiah 1:5, and you see the same precise use of language. In other words, to make a long story short, everybody in this room is a custom-made creation. God made you hands-on. He knows who you are, and He made you special. Now, from that, it seems pretty logical to go on to conclude that you are then made for a specific, special purpose in this world. Specifically designed for a specific job. Now, let me ask you a question. Supposing that's true. Supposing that you, let me pick on Wes, you know, our Russian friend from last night. Supposing that Wes is designed by God for a specific function in this world, and that somehow Wes doesn't quite see it, and he tries doing something else. He can. It's possible. We can do other things than what we're designed for. But will he ever really be happy? See, if you are a Corvette, are you going to be happy, condemned to spend the whole of your life doing 35 miles an hour? Uh-uh. No, you won't. I've owned three of those plastic toys. I know they're not happy going that fast, and I have the speeding tickets to prove it. So what I'm saying is, if you're designed for a specific function, then the best way in the world to spend a rather unsuccessful and unfulfilled life is to try to do something other than what you're made for. So it seems to me there's nothing more important than your identity, who you are and who God made you to be. Now, the irony of it is that very early in life, that identity, that thing that's specially you, starts getting assaulted. Fact of the matter is, they tell us now, it starts happening before you're ever born. Let me read something to you from a fascinating article in the Reader's Digest that tells how they've hooked up devices where they can actually now photograph what unborn kids are doing in the third trimester of pregnancy. They've got fiber optic stuff that now lets us see real time in living color what these little kids are doing. Now let me read it to you. The fascinating world of the unborn.
For 8 months, he has floated in his private ocean. This morning, he awakens, opens his eyes, yawns, and kicks vigorously several times. His umbilical cord drips by his fingers. He plays with it briefly, and then brings his hands up to his mouth and sucks his thumb. Over his mother's heartbeat, he can hear her talking with his father. Interested, he stops sucking his thumb and listens. Now, he isn't going to understand whatever language he's hearing, but you suppose he might understand tones of voice? Yeah, I think so. Well, he goes on like that, and I'll give you just enough so you get a feel for what happened to you a while back. A radio startles him. He blinks and grimaces at the new sensation, but then he becomes interested in the music. He turns his head to bring his ear closer to the outside world. Well, once again, you can ask yourself, what's he hearing? He notices the pressure of the book his mother has resting on her tummy. He kicks at it. She pats the spot where he kicked, and entering into the spirit of the game, he kicks back. They play several rounds of this game before he loses interest and falls asleep. 8 months, not even born. Now, the point I'm getting at is this. If the Lord made you specially, custom-made for a special purpose, but even before you're born, you start to impinge on this big, wild world in which a lot of forces are trying to push you away from where you're supposed to go. Do you see how even way back early, before you can even access this stuff in your memories, you're starting to encounter pressures to be something other than what the Lord designed for you to be? Well, then along comes grade school, and boy, you better line up, because if you're any different from the rest of the kids, you know what you get on the playground? Yeah. Nobody more merciless on the nonconformist than our kids in grade school. And so you begin to learn. You better line up. You better worry about what other people think about you. And gradually your thinking drifts away from what I am designed to be to what they want me to be. Then along comes the big day and you arrive at Monterey Bay Academy or wherever you go to school. Find your dorm room and you discover you're in a totally new world now. You're out of the family. You're in this big ocean of other opinions. And pretty soon, unless you're awfully indifferent to what other people think, you start caring about how they perceive you. You know, it kind of gets to be a thing in your mind, doesn't it? Are the other kids really digging my act? Okay? And then, I don't know whether they let you do this here, but comes the night when Tom decides to call Sally. He's been watching her on campus for a couple of weeks, and he knows he would like to get to know her better. He calls her up and says, Sally, this is Tom. Who? Tom. And I was kind of wondering if you would like to go to the school banquet with me on the 24th. Who'd you say this was? Tom. What was that date, the 24th? I'm sorry. I think I'm going to be sick that night. And all of a sudden, what happens? What is Tom thinking? Hey, what's wrong with me? See? Okay. So we tune into other people, and we begin to get our view of ourselves from other people, and what could happen if you do that? You could lose a sense of how special you are. There's the risk. Now, seems to me that there is nothing more important to you than your identity. Now, while you're sorting all this stuff out, along comes another way to spend your time. It's called mass entertainment. And you sit down in front of a VCR or in a movie theater, if that's your thing, and along comes a guy by the name of Tom Cruise. And he's walking across the lid of an aircraft carrier, and he gets into a fighter. Top-of-the-line stuff. And Maverick puts on his helmet, buckles in, and the lid comes down on the cockpit. And every 3 to 5 seconds, you are seeing a different view of what he's doing, and it gets pretty exciting. And behind all this stuff is a dynamite soundtrack. And he gets blasted off the deck of that carrier with both burners just roasting, heading for a classic fur ball of MiGs. And he's saying, anytime, baby. And he's going to come back and land that airplane. Why? Not because he's any better than you could be in those circumstances, but because the script writer said so. That's how come he gets back safe. Okay? Now, he's 14 feet tall on the big screen of a theater, and you look at him, and all of a sudden, somewhere during the course of this movie, you say, hey, you know, I'm just noticing something. It doesn't happen with me like that. When I call up Sally, she tells me she's going to be sick in 2 weeks. But when Tom Cruise goes after the girl, she falls into his waiting arms. I'm tired of being me. I'd rather be him. And you lose a sense of who you are. Now, you know, we've heard a lot of stuff for years in the Adventist church about mass entertainment, you know, why it's good or why it's bad. And you ask people, why is it wrong to go and see this, that, or the other thing? And you get lots of answers. But I just wonder if we've ever really gotten the right one. Maybe the biggest risk in watching a lot of fiction and getting kind of absorbed in it is you get dissatisfied with who you are and you get to wanting to be somebody else. There's a possibility. I'm convinced tonight that every one of you is custom designed to do a special job. There are people in this room who could handle a presidency every bit as well as any of the last three presidents we've had. Now, that may not be too big a compliment, but I mean it that way, okay? There are people here with a wealth of talent. Don't lose sight of who you are and why you're here, and don't let anybody steal from you the most important thing you've got. That is you, your own self. Long time ago, a lady who was by that time getting to be a grandmother had something to say to young people. Her name was Ellen White, and I think for a lot of very unfortunate reasons, we have kind of come to picture her as somebody who was born old. You know, she's a grandmother when she was born. Well, let me tell you something. She was 17 years old when she helped to start this thing we call Adventism. She started out young. And sometimes I think we kind of erroneously believe that she got her jollies by ruining the happiness of kids. Well, let me read something to you that tells you another side of her. Because what she was really saying was, you can be something more special than you ever dreamed of being if you don't lose sight of why you're here. And in the book, Messages to Young People, she said something with which I'd kind of like to close tonight. She said, dear youth, what is the aim and purpose of your life? Are you ambitious for education that you may have a name and position in the world? Have you thoughts that you may one day stand on the summit of intellectual greatness, that you may sit in deliberative and legislative councils and help to enact laws for the nation? There's nothing wrong in these aspirations. You may, every one of you, make your mark. Aim high and spare no pains to reach the standard. Balanced by right principles, you may climb to any height you please. That's your legacy. That's the Advent message. That's what it means for you. Shall we pray? Heavenly Father, we thank you for some of the best people in the world, people who haven't yet learned to compromise with truth and give up on it. Help them to never forget who they are and why they're here, and help every one of them to be the best they can be. In Jesus' name, amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2009, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry, as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.